Hi, I'm Dr. Chris Cannon, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us in today's educational activity. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, an award-winning accredited provider of continuing medical education for clinicians across the globe. There are several really neat features that are being offered by CME Outfitters. They're providing resources for both patients and providers. So first, CME Outfitters would like to try and integrate digital health tools, and so they partnered up with a group called Pack Health, and will offer to 75 patients personalized digital health coaching for up to 3 months. Then for clinicians, CME Outfitters will be offering an e-consult service at no cost for up to 100 clinicians who sign up. The group Arista MD will be providing the e-consult service to clinicians at no cost for a 30-day period. And then finally, CME Outfitters has developed two patient education tools. One really nice whiteboard animation that describes non-valvular atrial fibrillation, its symptoms, risk factors, and treatment, as well as a downloadable list of questions that the patient could ask their doctor or healthcare professional regarding non-valvular atrial fibrillation. So, want to introduce us as a group. My name is Chris Cannon. I'm the education director at the Cardiovascular Medicine Institute, or Innovation, at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and a professor at Harvard Medical School. And looking forward to an active discussion that will focus on strategies and tools for improving care. And we'll begin with a good friend, colleague, and world expert, Dr. Elaine Heilig, who's the director of the Thrombosis and Anticoagulation Service at Boston Medical Center and a professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine here in Boston. Also want to introduce Dr. Deepak Bhatt, another good friend and colleague, and he's the executive director of interventional cardiovascular programs at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the Heart and Vascular Center, and also a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. So want to welcome both of you for this terrific program, and we look forward to being a global community with all of you who are joining online. And all right, well, let's move on to our third section where we'll have a learning objective of aiming to try and implement guideline-directed therapy for appropriate use of oral anticoagulation for the patients who have non-valvular AFib, again, with the goal of reducing stroke. And so we'll begin with a question here. If we have a patient with a prior stroke who comes into the office and has an ECG showing AFib, what would not be the appropriate next step? So A is refer to a cardiologist, B, assess their risk of thromboembolism, C, initiate therapy with antiplatelet therapy for stroke prevention, and D, initiate treatment with oral anticoagulant therapy. Why don't we turn to guidelines, and we'll start in Europe. They have more colorful guideline figures in the European guidelines. So, Elaine, do you want to walk us through the...
Sure. So these are the European Society of Cardiology 2012 guidelines. You can see I'd already mentioned this lone atrial fibrillation. If you're young, less than 65 years, no structural heart disease, that even in the presence of atrial fibrillation, again, because you don't have all of those extra risk factors, the risk of stroke is really just not high enough to justify being on an anticoagulant. You know, absolutely, I mean, you need to know the CHA2DS2-VASc score, and how you figure that out right there in the office should be second nature. For individuals like all of us caring for this patient population. But here we have, if your CHA2DS2-VASc score is 1, the European guidelines recommend an oral anticoagulant or suggest, clearly with the patient preferences in mind. And if you're 2 or above, absolutely an oral anticoagulant therapy is what's recommended. And here in the 2012 guidelines, they actually had a box about calculating this HAS-BLED score, which I think I'm going to talk about on a subsequent slide that's really looking at bleeding risk. And here with the European guidelines, there was a preference for NOAC use, but clearly vitamin K antagonists providing, you know, you can keep that INR in the range where it needs to be effective, that certainly was another option, but with the preference for the NOAC, at least in 2012.
Yeah. And then what about, what are our current guidelines here in the U.S.?
So if we like sort of look at the 2014 American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association, Heart Rhythm Society guidelines, I mean, I would really say they're pretty much the same except for the aspirin, and, you know, our audience can read through each of these. But the CHA2DS2-VASc score of 1... In the United States, it's still like aspirin versus don't do anything versus, you know, an anticoagulant, and that's really sort of, I think, a debate right now. We probably all have different opinions about the CHA2DS2-VASc1. I would be tending to use anticoagulation in even those patients, but again, it's sort of looking at the whole patient comprehensive care. So that was definitely a bit of a departure. And then in addition to that, again, I mean, I direct a large, you know, anticoagulation clinic. There certainly are individuals on warfarin, but you really need to be sure that INR is in the 2 to 3 range. I think most of the metrics now are 70% of the time, which isn't always easy to achieve, but I think that's right. Really. So a CHA2DS2-VASc score of 2 above, anticoagulation, CHA2DS2-VASc score of 1. Whether this will change with the next iteration, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and aspirin sort of in or out, that's been coming out of the guidelines. And are there subsequent sort of consensus documents on antiplatelet therapy and the...
Well, certainly you can speak to the coronary, but for atrial fibrillation, I think that the field has clearly, and I think dramatically, shifted away from aspirin. And the main reason is because when you look at the older population, let's say 70, 75 or above, the bleeding risk on aspirin actually is very near or almost equivalent, and there are two studies for our viewers, the BAFTA trial and the Averroes trial, I think were both studies that looked at aspirin and an anticoagulant, and they were both, I think, very sea change of how we think about aspirin because of the bleeding risk in the older population. So you're not buying much on safety there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably just been an underappreciation of the fact that aspirin, especially in that age group, carries a substantial risk, and that anticoagulants, whether it's well-managed warfarin or particular or NOAC, that's renally adjusted appropriately, is really quite safe. You know, you mentioned that we might differ here, but CHA2DS2-VASc1, I myself would typically use a NOAC if there was no contraindication, the person was at low bleeding risk.
Yeah.
Would you do different, Chris?
Yeah, no, same. I'm definitely in the treat. I just picture that atrium not moving. And so, all right, well, why don't we come back to the polling question? And again, this was a patient arriving in your office who's had a prior stroke and AFib on the EKG. What would not be the right next step? And so we have the full array of refer to a cardiologist as the wrong thing to do, 25% of people. Then assess the risk of thromboembolism as the wrong thing. I think that is a key step to do. Initiate antiplatelet therapy. This was the plurality, I guess, at 38%. I think that is the correct answer of what not to do on the basis of really lack of efficacy for stroke prevention from atrial fibrillation. And then I think we're relearning the bleeding risk there.
Yep.
So. All right, well, why don't we quickly go through then, the NOACs have been a really wonderful story. This is sort of the timeline of, we now have in the United States 4 approved for treatment of patients with atrial fibrillation. And so this becomes a wonderful set of options for us. And Deepak, do you want to go through sort of the algorithm of how we treat these patients?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think the NOACs really have been a major development in the care of atrial fibrillation. And at this point in time, the majority of new prescriptions in the United States and in many regions of the world for atrial fibrillation is a NOAC. It's no longer warfarin. So things have really changed. And I think that's supported by the data. The data are really quite robust for NOACs, primarily due to the fact that they reduce the risk of intracranial hemorrhage, even versus well-controlled warfarin, even when the time and therapeutic range is high. So again, assuming renal function is adjusted for, it's hard to beat NOACs. This particular slide just shows one sort of algorithm, and just to remind everybody, mechanical heart valves or moderate or severe native mitral valve stenosis, what I just said doesn't apply. Those patients should be on carefully monitored warfarin. That's the standard of care and isn't about to imminently change. There's some small trials ongoing.
To clarify, this is actually the updated European guidelines, the 2016 guidelines. And the purpose of putting this here was just to show that Hazblood score is now no longer being put in as the preemptory box before you make a decision. But really to really do a checklist and figure out what is my patient maybe doing, what types of behaviors, what's happening that may increase the risk of bleeding. And, you know, certainly non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, ibuprofen, are contraindicated if you're on an anticoagulant. They raise the risk of GI bleeding 19-fold. So I tell all of my patients, we need to find something else for you for varied things that we all feel. Alcohol, I mean, a lot of different things can really raise the risk of bleeding. And I think that it's a beautiful document. The European Heart Rhythm Practical Guide in AF goes through all of these things, safety checks at home, making sure our patients have rubber-soled shoes, no loose carpeting, minimizing falls. But it's a really wonderful checkbox, and I think I would encourage people just download it.
Yeah, those practical points are really good ones, too. Yeah. Something that we don't always tell our patients, but really should. Yeah, one other thing as well in these guidelines is they do just mention the possibility of left atrial appendage occlusion, too. That is a bit more of a long story to try to figure out how to integrate that into practice, but potentially in a patient that's at very high bleeding risk, is unable to tolerate anticoagulation for the long term, you know, it's an option to consider. Though at least the current guidelines and package inserts for those devices say you have to be on antithrombotic therapy for a period of time after implant. That makes it a little trickier.
Terrific. Well, we're having so much good discussion, we probably should, we have lots to cover. We'll show briefly, Christian Ruff did a nice meta-analysis of stroke reduction, and this has been seen across the different trials and the combined at the bottom, a wonderful advance, and this is compared with warfarin. So the next slide after this looks at the safety, I believe, so if we can, there on bleeding, that there's an advantage on bleeding. And, you know, in part it may be less variability, but I think also certainly for intracranial hemorrhage, an advantage of preventing intracranial hemorrhage with the NOACs.
And that's right, a big deal because that translates into reduction in all-cause mortality. It's about a 50% reduction in intracranial hemorrhage, so ultimately about a 10% reduction in all-cause mortality. So makes for a really appealing prospect
right,
to switch.
Right, but you know, the other important thing is to, you know, the GI bleeding, again, it's not intracranial hemorrhage. Thank God that's a rarer outcome of being on an anticoagulant. It was reduced by 50% by these new agents. But also important to embrace, unfortunately, we didn't get it all. We didn't get the blue sky with these drugs either, because the gastrointestinal bleeding is something we still have to figure out, we have to solve. And just again for our viewers, is that the patient populations in each of these trials was different. And the Rocket Atrial Fibrillation trial, for example, their patient population had a CHADS score, I think, of average 3.5. The Engage AF TIMI trial was a average CHADS, not CHADS VASC, CHADS score of 2.8. And Aristotle and RELY study about CHADS of 2.1. So even though this was a very well done study, bringing it all together by Christian, I mean, it's not as simple as just looking at these and making big decisions, because the patient populations were a bit different, and that may, at least to some degree, have shaped some of the results.
Yeah. And what about persistence, Elaine? You know, one of the key is trying to make sure that people can get the long-term prevention, and we see some differences across the different classes and agents.
So this is just one study. I think there's many studies now coming out looking at, well, once we prescribe these medicines, are patients able to stay on them? And I think, you know, overall at the six-month mark, about three-quarters, more than that, 78%, you can see. But I think across the board, to me, it's concerning that we drop down to like 70, 60% at 1 year. of patients being on these medicines, and I think that we really need to fully understand that. These patients aren't really being followed in an anticoagulation clinic where they're being pestered every month. Are you on your medicine? Are you getting your INR checked? I think patients might be making decisions because their pulse seems regular. It seems regular today. Why do I need this medicine? I'm not in that other rhythm anymore. Maybe they're stopping the medicine. Maybe they see scary ads on television. Or, you know, other things are just the polypharmacy and the cost, I think, just starts to build. And so individuals will start, you know, doing it every other day to kind of not go into that donut hole. And I think it's complicated. But this, to me, is one of the biggest challenges in cardiovascular health.
Oh, absolutely.
Is persistence.
It might be a little bruising or something that we might not think, oh, that's a big deal. It's not really bleeding. It's just some bruising. But the patient might perceive it as a risk for major bleeding yet to come. So yeah, I think there needs to be a lot of care and education just around the potential side effects, potential bleeding, what's bad bleeding, you know, what might be more sort of tolerable bleeding.
The right. other aspect is the dose. And, you know, with the warfarin, it's titrated to the INR. Sometimes people aim low. But with the NOACs, often people are put on by us, the doctors, too low a dose. And can you speak to how often that occurs?
Well, you know, it's a little, let me just say that the estimates of using the low dose are a little bit different. Globally, with the lower doses of certainly apixaban, dabigatran, and rivaroxaban, Germany, France, Japan, name the country, it's about 40-50% are using the low dose. I think physicians fear that, you know, if a bleeding event occurs, it's my fault. But somehow if someone has a stroke, it's just sort of fate. Or, I mean, I don't know how doctors think. They think that by choosing the lower dose, 2.5 twice a day, for example, of apixaban, that they're appropriately running through the raindrops with patients that are very complex, not to say. But we know that there is a real trade-off when we're choosing the lowest dose. And I would have to say the Engage AF study really showed us that there's a floor to, you know, how low you can go before you lose the efficacy. And in that low dose arm strategy with the doxaban, I mean, the compared to vitamin K antagonists, the risk of ischemic stroke was increased by 40%. And then being in an academic medical center, I always tell our residents and junior faculty that when you're consuming the data, read the method sections of those papers, because if in that registry, that big data study, you know, if they're not telling you the doses that those patients were taking, it's very difficult to interpret the bleeding rates and the ischemic stroke rate. So again, just sort of a caution as to why in the United States we seem to be using apixaban in the low dose about 25% of the time. And fascinating with the dabigatran, we did not get the 110 dose in the United States, but we got this 75 milligram dose, which was only for individuals with really severe renal disease. And how we're using that in the U.S. is also a bit of a conundrum.
Yeah. And actually, Deepak, do you want to review some of the data that talks about underdosing and by the different risk patient populations?
Sure. And the data here just amplify the point that Elaine nicely made, which is that there's a lot of underdosing going on out there. And it's sort of inappropriate underdosing. That is, it would be fine to dose appropriately if someone has renal dysfunction. And the package inserts and guidelines are very clear about how to do that. But the underdosing, I think, as she pointed out, really has more to do with fear of bleeding and not necessarily related to patient risk. And, you know, one thing I've seen a lot of is older patients where even if the renal function's reasonably well preserved, they're underdosed because of fear of bleeding. But, of course, those are the patients that are particularly high stroke risk. So it really is a challenge there.
Yeah. And then the converse of that is in a renally compromised patient, overdosing, that also happens. And so this dose is really a key thing. You want to touch on these?
Well, I think the overdosing, I can understand the underdosing because physicians did the same thing with INR targets with warfarin of 1.5 to 2.5 or 2 to 2.5. The overdosing, I think, is really, is even, you know, the same concern because, one, our doctor's calculating a creatinine clearance. You can't just eyeball a creatinine creatinine value in someone who's 80, 85, a creatinine of 0.8, and say, oh, the kidney function seems to be okay. You really need, except for apixaban, where there was a cutoff of a 1.5, the other agents, other studies use the creatinine clearance using the Cockcroft-Gault equation, and I think that's critical. So some of this overdosing may be physicians kind of not really calculating, but looking at a creatinine. The other issue here may be that for patients with fluctuating renal dysfunction or acute kidney injury, that, you know, there probably is a safe, or a, what should I say, not safe, but an interval of testing the creatinine clearance in these patients on drugs that are being renally cleared. Yeah. So we've gotten away from monitoring the INR with warfarin every 2 to 3 weeks, but we can't lose sight of individuals, you know, heart failure, you know, potent diuretics, you know, just not taking in, you know, good oral intake. I mean, those patients should be followed a little bit more closely. Maybe every 4 months would make sense to make sure that you don't get stuck with a patient being on a dose where they perhaps should be on the lower dose.
And of course, these are all older patients that start with sort of lower creatinine clearance to begin with. And, you know, I've had that happen to myself with too long an interval and, you know, presenting with bleeding. So.
Right. Or some intracurrent illness comes up, or they start an NSAID, even though Elaine said not too big of GI bleeding, but then that affects their creatinine. So all sorts of stuff can happen. So unless you're keeping a close eye on the creatinine, especially during those periods of transitions of health, bad stuff can happen.
Well, I want to quickly touch on a very high-risk group and those that have both non-valvular atrial fibrillation and PCI, and you need dual antiplatelet therapy for the PCI, and so then you're left with triple therapy. And this has been an area where we know there's just going to be too much bleeding. And Deepak, you led a meta-analysis of the trials to date. Do you want to walk through this slide?
Yeah, absolutely. And this incorporates really all the key trials, trials like ISAR triple, WOST, Pioneer, and the one that you led, of course, Redual PCI. And taken together as a class, these NOACs reduce TIMI bleeding by a substantial amount versus conventional triple therapy. So a strategy largely of double therapy, an antiplatelet plus an anticoagulant, beats dual antiplatelet therapy plus, you know, full dose warfarin. And is there any downside to that? Well, at least when you pull all these data together, thousands of patients, not tens of thousands of patients, but thousands of patients, we don't see a signal with respect to higher rates of mortality or myocardial infarction or stent thrombosis or stroke. So there doesn't seem to be a trade-off that we can detect with respect to thromboembolic complications such as stroke or coronary complications such as stent thrombosis. So I think for the majority of patients with AFib who end up needing a stent, the strategy that's best is a default strategy of triple therapy in the hospital. So, for example, aspirin, clopidogrel, plus appropriately renally dosed NOAC, followed by discharge on just two agents, typically clopidogrel and then the NOAC.
Excellent. Well, I'll just share the guidelines just updated. This was updated in August, where the options there that you laid out of triple therapy on the left is one, and then thinking about dual therapy as an approach, either do triple therapy they offered for 1 month and then switching to dual therapy. And then on the next slide, we had in the North American side of things, we were both a part of this discussion looking over the data that now with the data that you just had in that meta-analysis, we notion of a default strategy of the dual therapy. But then, of course, leaving some risk stratification. If someone just had a left main stent and it was sort of a younger, lower bleeding risk, but very high thrombotic risk, you know, there you'd say, let's do some triple therapy for a period of time. And I think that notion with reasonable evidence base and another trial coming early next year will be exciting.